complication, and it's an old lecture. Consider my reputation as something more than white. I know it serves me right, but I can't sleep at night. Have to hide my face or go some other place. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Ron Edgar from The Music Machine. Today is July 11th, 2010, and I'm talking to Ron Edgar. Ron, would you please give me your full name, your birth date, and hometown?
Well, my name is Ron Edgar, E-D-G-A-R. I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 1946, in June 25th, 1946.
Well, what part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in the Hopkins, Glen Lake area, Corcoran, Hamel area. My dad had a farm, and we had a farm out there, and then he wanted to be a bartender, and then he wanted to work for, you know, these different companies, you know, stuff like that. But mostly I did most of my growing up in the Hopkins, Glen Lake area.
What high school did you attend?
Hopkins Senior High School. And at that point time, it was on Highway 7, where the Eisenhower Community Center is. And then Hopkins High School moved to Cedar Lake Road there in North Hopkins.
And what year did you graduate?
1964.
When did you start playing drums?
I started playing drums when I was about 12 or 13. My dad bought me a little drum set from Sears and Roebuck, figuring that I was going to be a old-time drummer. My uncle was, his name was Norbert Schunk, and he played the hell out of the concertina. And so he really got jazzed over that and thought that perhaps, you know, if I were to play drums, then I would be able to be in a band with him. And everybody was all excited about that. So he invested in it, right? But unfortunately, I didn't have any eyes, you know, to play in a old-time band. I wanted to play jazz.
Was old-time music polka music? And
yeah, old-time music basically is Polish music, German music. At least in my family, that's what it was.
Okay.
And polkas, waltzes, schottisches, you know, and there was, according to my family, there was a lot of difference between the German old-time music and the Polish German. You know, and then they used to get all excited about that. No, wait a minute, now this is you know, it used to go on and on and on about it, you know.
Where did you develop this interest in jazz music?
Oh, that was interesting. I met... and back in those days, you see, there was very few musicians, especially in high school, who could play anything but a three-chord song. Most of them were into surf music and Beach Boys and Jan and Dean and all that. But this fellow, his name was Eldon Fredin. He played a Gibson L5, hollow body. Quite amazing guitarist. And then I met another fellow that went to South High School by the name of Larry Hutchinson. And Larry Hutchinson played upright bass. So that was just a natural to get the three of us together because we could play music, let's say, from the Three Sounds and Miles Davis and, you know, all kinds of straight-ahead jazz.
You're all... in high school at this point?
All in high school, yeah.
Okay. Do you have an official name for the band? Or?
Yes, it was called the Contemporary Jazz Trio.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Huh.
Where did you practice?
Over at Eldon's house. Eldon Fredin was the guitarist, and he resided in Glen Lake. Huh. He had a house up there, and it was more like a basement, but it was soundproof, and I brought my drum set up there, and it stayed up there. You know, until we would play out, you know.
You actually played some jobs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did.
Where did you play?
Well, at Hopkins High School, we played a prom. there one time. And the band director used to let me, used to write a pass so I could get out. And we used to do these little fashion shows and stuff, you know, down at the at this hotel called the Leamington Hotel back in those days, early 60s. And we did actually two or three jobs. We had a fantastic little job at this pizza place. See, back in those days, the pizza joints were had all kinds of jazz in them. Valley Pizza, Hopkins Pizza in town there, right in Excelsior Boulevard by Blake Road, that whole that area right there. And we had that job on weekends. You'd make a whole $27, you know, playing there a weekend. Oh. You know, it was fun though, and we really got to hone our chops. In those little places, playing some really nice tunes. And I never really cared for folk music, and I never really cared for early rock and roll, you know, like surf music and stuff. Once you play some sophisticated music with some real finesse, you just don't feel like being a sweat hog and, you know, smacking the hell out of the drums, you know.
Were you listening to WDGY or KDWB or not?
No. I listened to them only because if I had a girlfriend and we went dancing, that's what would happen, you know, at school or something, you know.
Did you go out and see any of the local rock bands?
Not very many of them, no. I knew where they all played, you know, but I was never really into early rock and roll at all.
Well, at that time period, 63 would have been the Trashmen with Surfin' Bird.
Yeah. I used to see their, being St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Glen Lake area, I used to see their van in the Knollwood parking lot all the time. And I knew they had a rock hit called, you know, Surfin' Bird or whatever it was. The bird is the word, you know. So I was, you know, quite aware of just watching their advertising all the time, you know, on their truck, you know, on their van, running around. And they had a lot of gigs back in those days.
Did your jazz band continue after high school or not?
No. When I was in the, I had a chance to join this band called the Goldbriars. Now, I think I mentioned this to you when we were down at Famous Dave's for a little impromptu interview. That was interesting because the Goldbriars, you know, had a very fine producer called Kurt Becher. Kurt Becher is... He went on to produce The Association, Along Comes Mary, and Sweet Pea, and
by Tommy Rowe.
Yeah, right. And there was a lot of records, really, that I can't even remember back in those days that he did. But he had a fantastic voice. Now he was in a this folk group called the Goldbriars.
And who else was in the band?
There was two sisters, the Holmberg sisters, Sherry and Dottie Holmberg. They played the feminine interest in the band. It was sort of a bohemian look, you know, black turtlenecks and earrings and long dresses that they wore. And then we had we went electric at that time, which was sort of unusual for a so-called folk group. So we started playing this folk music, and it didn't sound right, you know, because you think of folk music being like the Kingston Trio or, you know, something like that, all acoustic guitars. No, this was had electric bass and electric guitar, semi-hollow body electric guitar, and then acoustic guitar. You had Kurt played an old D-28 Martin. Then, of course, my drum set. So it was a nice folk group, and we just rehearsed and rehearsed, and we had a nice show.
Did both girls play guitars?
No, they just sang.
Okay.
They were singers, yeah.
So who played the other guitars? Just
well, Kurt played rhythm guitar and sang. Right. Of course, a lot of the lead vocals. Okay. They hummed and... You know, behind him, and ooh and ah, and created a nice background for him. We didn't sing. Murray and I and Tom didn't sing. Tom was the bass player. Murray Planta, he played electric guitar.
Okay.
He had a little Fender twin. he played it through.
Do you recall Tom's last name?
It'll come to me.
So had you gone out and seen this band play before you joined them, or how did you get connected with the Goldbriars?
Larry Hutchinson lived in South Minneapolis. Now, Larry Hutchinson was the upright bass player that I just mentioned that was in this contemporary jazz trio that I just was talking to. His house was a rehearsal place for us, for this folk group. And I was intending on leaving the band, the jazz trio, and going on the road, because basically I just wanted to get the hell out of town. And it was a way of being able to do that. And so we rehearsed as a electric folk band. And they were booked by William Morris Agency out of New York. They had recorded a couple of albums by then. And they were working on another later album, which I also played on, but I don't think it was ever released.
Where did the Goldbriars play in town?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. They just simply rehearsed.
Yes. They were just there to rehearse and pick up players.
Okay.
Ron Nielsen was a vibraphonist, and also he played banjo. And he was another person that his future was not in this particular band. He was in the previous Goldbriars band, which would have been all acoustic. And when they went electric, when Kurt Becher and the Goldbriars decided to become an electric band, electric folk band, meaning that they had electric instruments and acoustic instruments and sung. They did mostly cover tunes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hootenanny type stuff, you know. And there was a venue for it back in those days. And Charleston, South Carolina, this 300 King Street, was the place that we were headed. So we got all of our instruments, and after we had our sound down and had our hair dyed.
Dyed black?
Dyed black, and had our earrings installed. We got in a 1953 Woody Buick, and headed down to Charleston, South Carolina, being stalled in the Chicago Loop on the way with a flat tire.
Oh.
Then we were down in Tennessee someplace or in the mountains, and we had to do a valve job on the Buick because it just broke down on us. So that kind of took all of our money, traveling money, right? So we finally got down to Charleston, South Carolina, and playing shows and stuff. And I'll tell you that we did these matinees for the kids and Saturday matinees, and they would just be lined up around the block. They had to turn them away.
Was that a hot spot for folk music?
It was. It was. It was. It was a really nice, dark kind of a coffee house mm-hmm. back in those days, with a sort of a two-tiered, you know, a loft and a main room.
Is this still in 64 after you've graduated, or?
Yes.
64, okay.
Late 64.
Late 64.
September, that's when I left with the band.
Mm-hmm.
65 rolled around, I was still with the band. And
now, were the Goldbriars, were they from Minneapolis, or were they just passing through, or were they
well,
based?
Most of them, no, I think Kurt, I think he was from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Kurt was, okay.
Yes, Kurt Becher.
And the two
he
gals
the,
were
He was
from
the main, there? The leader of the band, and the main singer, yeah.
Okay, and the sisters were from Minneapolis?
I believe they were, okay. Yeah.
But there really wasn't a big folk scene in Minneapolis.
Not to my knowledge, and I wouldn't have been into it anyway.
Had they had any success with their first two albums?
Oh, the first one, well, was on a Columbia Epic Records, division of Columbia Records at that time. And they had a contract, and I remember we did a recording event. It was kind of an event rather than just studio time, because there was a famous jazz drummer there, and he was going to do my part for me, because the band, Kurt Becher, didn't believe that I could cut those parts, or at least he wanted to use someone who could play time like a click track. And he was always like one step ahead of where I was at. And his name was Eddie Shaughnessy. Now, Eddie Shaughnessy played with Johnny Carson. He was the drummer of the Johnny Carson band for 100 years or a long time. Mm-hmm. And he did studio work in New York City. And this was in an old church in Midtown or around there. So the Goldbriars, traveling with the Goldbriars, we went to New York City to record the third album and got most of it done. Then the band broke up in 1965.
And that album was never released?
To my knowledge, it never was. Hmm. The first two were. They're interesting. You could probably find them if you Google it on your computer. At least you'd be able to see the what the album covers look like and see the band.
At what point do you meet Sean Bonnewell?
Oh, yeah. Sean Bonnewell. He was one of the main singers in a group called the Wayfarers. And the Wayfarers owned 300 King Street. And he wanted to sell his interest in it because he had basically lost interest in the group in terms of recording and carrying on the whole folk. He just had an idea, and gratefully he did. You know, he said, I'm going some other place, but I don't know where it is yet, but folk music isn't going to be happening much longer. I just feel it, and I want to get into a tougher, more looking image, and I want to play rock and roll. I said, well, okay. And he said, I would really like you to be the drummer, because you know what you're doing. You're not just thrashing away. Plus, I like your personality. And actually, I thought perhaps, you know, he would have been a big influence on me. And of course, he was further on in terms of what to play, how to listen, just these particular things that drummers really need to know when they move along, not just thrashing away and being a sweat hog on stage like there are so many, but to be an individual and, you know, to use a lot of, used to call it like elephant ears, you know. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting thing. Anyway, he was big time in my growing years in terms of music back in those days.
So Sean was...
I really liked rock and roll in terms of what he was introducing, because it was all original music. It was no covers.
So Sean was looking for something other than the folk music scene.
Definitely, yeah, okay. He was. And that's why when we saw Keith Olsen after he had left, you see, what had happened previous to that, he said, well, look, I'll tell you what. I'm selling my interest in the Wayfarers, and I'll be your road manager.
For the Goldbriars.
For the Goldbriars, right. I understand that you might be going west, and that's where I want to go. So we went up to Cellar Door there, and that's where I met Keith, Gail Garnett.
This is in Los Angeles now?
No, the Cellar Door is in Washington, D.C.,
okay, so you were on...
So we just kind of headed north there a little bit from South Carolina, up the coast.
So you and the Wayfarers traveled?
The Wayfarers didn't come along, only Sean.
Okay.
Sean sold his interest in the Wayfarers, and he was out of there. And so he rode along and became our, so to speak, road manager until we got out to Los Angeles.
But you met Keith first... Where now?
In Washington, D.C., at a folk club called the Cellar Door.
And Keith Olsen was playing with?
He was playing upright bass for Gail Garnett.
Who had a hit song.
He had a hit song called We'll Sing in the Sunshine.
Right.
And he got, there's some of it in your little bio there, but he got pretty bored with that. And and he was listening to me and Sean talk about what we wanted to do. And he thought, yeah, why not, you know? This is just something different. And Sean, he was quite a talker, you know, and he could really, he was very convincing, and I really believe that we could pull it together. But it really didn't crystallize until we got out west. I think there was a little club around Anaheim out there in Anaheim, California. And the Goldbriars had played another little folk club out there called the Ice House, Pasadena Ice House. And that was quite a popular place for folk music at that particular time. Then we had another little job out in Anaheim, like I mentioned, and that's where I think this little trio had formed. We had gotten together and we started playing and practicing as a trio.
And the trio was who?
The trio was called, later called, the Ragamuffins.
And the three people were
myself, Ron Edgar, Sean Bonniewell, and Keith Olson.
Okay.
That's where the beginning of the Music Machine started.
Who came up with the name, the Ragamuffins?
That was Sean. Mm-hmm. As far as I know. I didn't.
Where does the band rehearse in Los Angeles?
San Pedro, California.
South of L.A.?
South of L.A. I don't know how many miles out there, but there are oil refineries out there. It's also a shipping port. And it's on a little street called Almeria Street. And he lived with a beautiful Mexican lady. And we rehearsed, or what I like to call practiced, we practiced in his garage. And even to this day, some people call what the Music Machine, or the Ragamuffins, in fact, did, started, was garage music, because I didn't know anybody else who played in a garage. And I'd never heard of anybody else back in those days who did it either. So, I mean, you know, I can understand how one would be able to, you know, name it that.
Garage rock was not a term used in the 60s.
That's correct, yeah.
Right, okay.
It didn't come up until way later. But we rehearsed as the Ragamuffins, and we'd play these little bars and dives, and a couple of them in San Pedro area. We played at one of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles and other places. Mm-hmm. Around. Played in a little club in the valley called the Casbah, which was an interesting place. But I think we did that, though, as a quartet or a quintet rather than just a trio.
So as the trio, the Ragamuffins,
yes.
What kind of music were you doing?
We're doing all original material.
All written by Sean?
That's correct.
It's quite a change from the folk music.
Oh, it was a big change, yeah. Mm-hmm. When we performed it, because we didn't have enough original material together, then we do covers. When we get to the hotels and stuff, like there was three or four, it's in your bio too, we used to do three or four rock and roll covers. Mm-hmm. All Day and All Night, that one, I think it was called, yeah. We used to do that.
By the Kinks?
Yeah. We used to do a lot of early rock and roll. We didn't do any surf music, though. Just mm-hmm.
Rolling Stones covers?
Under My Thumb. Mm-hmm. Tunes like that. Whenever we'd... and then we'd throw in a few original material. You know, some of that.
Did the Ragamuffins ever do Talk Talk?
I don't believe Talk Talk was written at that particular time.
Okay.
Later on, Sean may have written it, but he didn't, to my knowledge, mm-hmm. introduce it to the band until we were a quintet.
So as the Ragamuffins, as a three-piece, what kind of musical equipment was the band using?
It was very crude. It was just a big box, and it had a couple of speakers in it, and one phono plug where you could plug into it, one for a microphone. And you'd play the whole deal out of one box.
It was like a homemade plywood box?
Sure, just a plywood box with a couple of speakers in it. A couple of crossovers in it, and that's all it was.
What kind of drums were you playing?
Let me see, what did I have back in those days? I had a Rogers drum set, a black Rogers drum set, mm-hmm. that I had bought and financed in Hollywood when the Goldbriars got to Los Angeles. Now, what had happened is they were in a car, not my car, it was a friend's car, in a carport underneath the motel or hotel, I guess it was, apartment building. And somebody must have seen it, and they stole the drums. Mm. So, and that was a Gretsch set. It was a blue sparkle Gretsch set that I had bought as an amateur and paid off.
Okay, so you're on Roger's drums, and
yeah.
Sean is playing guitar?
Sean's playing guitar. I think he had a Gretsch single hollow body guitar. I can't remember what kind it was.
And Keith,
he had a sort of like a Hofner violin bass, electric bass. He also played a Fender Precision bass, too. And I think that one was Doug Rhodes, who played keyboards in the Music Machine.
Reading through this bio, Keith would kind of experiment with these electronic sounds as far as distortion and so forth.
Yeah. We had heard a fuzz box, either on a radio or something or other, but we didn't have any money to buy one. Because they were expensive. Everything was expensive. You know, he didn't have any money, of course. So he just went down to Radio Shack and picked up a little metal box and hooked up a couple of transistors in it. And he said, this should work, you know. And he just plugged into it, and it did. And it just had this cruel, scratchy fuzz tone to it. And I think that was... At that particular time is when the real idea behind the Music Machine was born, is when we got that sound. Because it was mean. It was a real mean song. You know, and everybody else back in those days were like, do-do-do-do-do. You know, they're just... It was just a kick-ass sound, you know. So Sean, he just loved it. He just thought that was, yeah, let's do that.